Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. Abigail Disney's father was Walt's nephew, Roy. For Abigail, growing up as a Disney came with a lot of perks, but also so much baggage that she almost ditched the name altogether.
There's a lot of it I'm not proud of, but there was enough of it to be proud of to listen when I heard it saying to me that I have work to do related to it. And that's what's, you know, I'm sorry, I'm not really a religious person, but it felt like there was a calling and I was going to have to try and figure out how to do that, whatever was called of me.
In the second half of our two-part interview, Abigail Disney reflects on what it means to have that famous last name and remembers how much things changed for her family when Michael Eisner took over the Walt Disney Company in 1984. But first on the News Banter, what does 2021 hold for Hollywood? Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my two banter buddies, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
And Bloomberg reporter Lucas Shaw. Hello, Lucas.
Hey, Kim.
So we're going to look to the year ahead, and I will start by saying, give me that vaccine. As soon as they're ready, I'll roll up my sleeve. But will people be in theaters? We have movies scheduled, and some of them may be essentially, I think, dumped in theaters. I don't believe the Bond date, for example. MGM has moved the Bond movie multiple times. It's now in April. I don't think so. What do you guys think, Lucas?
I think that MGM would like to release it then, but MGM would also be more than happy to find some company that either buys that movie or buys the whole company, as it has now for a couple of years. This has been a very famous entertainment studio, but one with a for sale on the front, because it's sort of this awkward size where it's not as big as the big companies, but not small enough to be an easy acquisition. Bond is the most valuable asset. And so pushing that movie to April both bought them time to see if the vaccine would be widely distributed by then, but also more time to figure out if they could find somebody to pay them the $8 or $10 billion they would like.
Okay, Matt, Lucas went straight to the merits of Bond, which is a perfectly valid point, but I want also to address the question of when do you think people will get back in theaters, which is impossible. You're not even an epidemiologist, but I'm going to ask you anyway.
Yeah, assuming the trajectories of the vaccine are what they say they are, and it becomes widely available to the public in April or May, I think that that date could hold. Keep in mind, the Bond franchise does about 70 to 75% of its revenue overseas, and they seem to have their act together a little bit more than the U.S. does. So I wouldn't be surprised if it held that date, but I think the first big global movie that generates a ton of money in the U.S. and overseas is probably going to be Black Widow, which is scheduled for that first weekend of May, that traditional Marvel opening weekend. Either that or the Fast and Furious movie over Memorial Day. Those, I think, are going to be the two biggies where people rally around them and say, okay, enough people have been vaccinated, let's go to the movies.
I'm probably a little optimistic, but I am sure Universal and Disney hope you're right. Lucas, did you have a thought you wanted to throw in there quick?
Yeah, I'm less optimistic about the performance. I think you're right that a studio will try it. There will have been enough time. There will have been enough people vaccinated that they figure why not and roll the dice. But as many people as there are who might be willing to rush out and go to the theater and support some new project, I think you'll still have a large percent of the population that either isn't vaccinated or is too scared because they're afraid of people who are not vaccinated.
But keep in mind, yes, I agree with you that there will be a large percentage of the population that is not vaccinated. But think about what we've been through for this past year and not being able to go to public places. Even if it's 100 million Americans that are vaccinated, people are going to want to go to the movies. They're going to want to go to restaurants. They're going to want to express their freedom in some way. And this is a very easy way for $20 to express your desire to be out amongst people. All of the models for what kind of people show up for Marvel movies on opening weekend, all of that's out the window. Even casual fans, even older people, even people who have no interest in Black Widow, the character, I think are going to want a communal experience.
Well, we'll find out. I know theater fans are hoping that theaters can make it. Let's talk about Warners in that context. Jason Kyler did this bold move. He put all the movies of 2021, citing the pandemic, we just are saying we don't believe that, onto the streaming service. There's a big fight going on. I am sensing that Hollywood is going to dig in its heels. We've seen the Directors Guild send a letter. We've seen the top heads of the agencies send letters. I predict that the Writers Guild, once they get settled with signing WME, which I believe will have happened possibly even by the time this airs, but they have basically made deals with all the major agencies. I believe the Writers Guild will also get involved because this affects people's revenues, and the residuals affect a lot of people in this community. So the question I have is, what is the consequence? What does Warners have to do? Some people have speculated that Kyler's in trouble. Some people think that John Stankey, the CEO of AT&T, may be in trouble because the rollout of HBO Max has been so bumpy. I mean, I guess it's a two-part question. Does HBO Max work with all? Does this goose HBO Max to a place where it needs to be to compete with Disney, which has taken off like a bottle rocket? And who pays the price for having done this to Hollywood? Because it feels to me that somebody will have to pay. There's going to have to be a sacrificial person to apologize to the community. Or maybe that's old school thinking. What do you think, Lucas?
I think those two thoughts are related. If they get HBO Max to grow at a rate that they're comfortable with, where the movies and TV shows are perceived as successes, and they then reward the talent for that success, and the talent feels like the movie was a moment, then there won't have to be a sacrificial lamb. But if the movies don't work, if HBO Max doesn't grow a bunch next year, then not only will the talent be mad at the executives at Warner Brothers, but shareholders in AT&T will be angry. You know, Jason Kyler will have to acknowledge that it didn't work. John Stankey, who has really supported him on this, will have to answer questions both of investors and of his staff. You know, we did all of this. We pissed all these partners off and it didn't even work. That's, to me, the either or. I think those two are now bundled together. And the big question is, will Wonder Woman and all these other movies drive faster growth for HBO Max?
What do you think, Matt?
I think there's no question that the HBO Max subscriber numbers are going to go up. I mean, they have full carriage now after the Roku deal. They have premium content. Wonder Woman is absolutely going to goose their subscribers. And keep in mind, at this point, they're still just trying to convince existing HBO subscribers to switch over to the HBO Max product that they already get for free. So that's not that high of a bar. Are they going to get to the Disney numbers? No. But I think the better question here is, what is considered a success for HBO Max, considering they have sacrificed this entire year's worth of theatrical for day and date releases on the service? And I don't know the answer to that question. I think, you know, if they got up to 30, 40, 50 million subscribers, that would be considered a huge success. But keep in mind that, you know, this plan for day and date releases at Warners extends well beyond what most people think the pandemic will impact into, you know, third and fourth quarter of the year. And my question to you, Kim, is, do you think that if the country and the world emerges from the pandemic late in 2021, will HBO Max stick to the plan to release these big movies like The Matrix in theaters and on HBO Max, or will they backtrack?
Well, again, it goes to the connected question, like, how does it do in the early going? I think that the mistake one of the mistakes that they made was to say it was the whole year, citing the pandemic, when it did not at all. They were simultaneously signaling that it was a whole strategy shift and doing the whole year. If they had said we're doing the first quarter, the second quarter, maybe they would have, I think, gotten away with it, honestly. And, you know, we're going to negotiate with our partners because we feel we can't do this. But when they lumped in the whole year, so we see the first 6 months go by and these things aren't performing, maybe they do backtrack. But I don't know. I feel like the transgression in the eyes of Hollywood of having done this the way they did it is so great that I'm not sure the patience is there. I'm talking about something that, you know, they have to do something that may be write much bigger checks than they intend to. But I do believe and predict that there will be litigation, possibly from multiple parties, if they don't cough up a lot of money to make this right. And I think it's a shorter term problem than waiting around till the end of the year to see how it worked.
And of course, if it does work, this is not just going to be a one-year thing. It's going to be a forever thing.
Well, and that gets to, is Warner's, you know, in the movie business as we understand it? I don't know. Lucas, any guesses?
If Wonder Woman is a big hit, it buys them a lot of time. They will have to pay all their partners. Most people in Hollywood don't like to sue, especially because most of the partners with Warner Brothers in this either already have projects that they're doing with them again or will want to again. I think they're just going to have to find a way to pay these people enough to make them happy, or at least pretend that they're happy. Because if you're a legendary, if you're a Village Roadshow, do you really want to be in a long lawsuit with Warner Brothers?
No, but you also don't want to allow precedent like that to go unanswered. So it's a tough one, and they'll certainly take it to the brink if they don't. They'll go into arbitration maybe, but one way or another, I think that they are going to have to at least make a, you know, maybe I'm not sure if this is really what gorillas do, but like beating on their chest to intimidate potential adversary, there's going to need to be a lot of that.
And also this whole practice could damage the box office for these Warner's movies as well. They're counting on a certain number, and we're seeing already the numbers from international on Wonder Woman are not good. And putting these movies on the service could cause box office problems to exacerbate. Think of all the other studios waiting to pounce on these release dates. You could see something like a Marvel movie opening opposite Matrix 4 because the pitch from Disney will be, go see the Marvel movie in theaters, see Matrix 4 on your TV. And that would further damage these talents that are attached to Warner's and further alienate them within the industry.
Yeah, this is a big one. Okay, you guys, we'll see what happens. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kim.
That's Matt Bellany, former editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter, and Lucas Shaw of Bloomberg. Coming up after a short break, Abigail Disney tells us which Disney character most reminds her of her grandfather, Walt's brother, Roy. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. Today, we're sharing part two of our conversation with Abigail Disney, filmmaker, podcast host, and daughter of Walt's nephew, Roy. In part one, Abigail called out top Disney executives for taking home millions as 32,000 low-wage workers at the theme parks lost their jobs. If you missed that, you can find it in our podcast feed. We're far from the days when Disney was a family-owned company, but Abigail remembers a time when her grandfather, Walt's brother Roy, kept the company on track, especially as Walt pursued more fantastical and expensive ideas. Abigail's grandfather handled the finances, and while she's mindful of the darker aspect of the company's history, she says Roy acted as a kind of corporate conscience.
Jiminy Cricket reminded me so much of my grandfather. He talked exactly like my golly gee willikers grandfather. And if you look at the dynamic between Walt and Roy, they were totally in and super ego. That's how they built the company, right? Walt would go off and do some maniac thing, and my grandfather would figure out where the money was going to come from and how to establish a copyright, how to trademark that and make sure the trademark law was working.
Yeah, the one who was like counting the numbers.
Yeah. And you know, it was the Disney Brothers studio at the beginning, and he didn't want that. He wanted Walt to get all the credit because he was the creative genius. But there was my grandfather with, like, the adding machine and the visor over, you know, his eyes and the garter on his sleeve, you know, figuring out how to get it done and figuring how to make sure it wouldn't die in the, you know, die on the vine. And,
what a legacy,
and like, that guy's really important. And what happened there was, you know, the way siblings can sing harmonies in a really very important way. They had a nice kind of yin-yang thing going on.
Abigail Disney acknowledges she's benefited from the family name her entire life, but she's given away much of her money. And as you may have heard in our previous interview with her, she's now a fierce critic of the company's employment policies. As Abigail Disney notes, and I've written a whole book about this, the Disney company underwent a big shift in the mid-1980s when Michael Eisner took over as CEO. Eisner and his team brought the drifting studio roaring back to life with hit movies, a revitalized animation division, and of course, hikes in the price of tickets to the theme parks. Eventually, Disney opened more theme parks and acquired ABC, ESPN, The Muppets. The company's values soared. And for Abigail Disney's family, it really was a whole new world. I was so struck by the way your family life changed. You know, you talked about the fact that you were really kind of a well-to-do family up until the Michael Eisner era, when, and this starts, I guess, around 1984. They come to Disney, which, you know, had been a little bit like hung up on this what would Walt do mentality.
Yeah, and it was a backwater.
Yes. And I wasn't going to say it quite that way, but yes.
I'm allowed.
You're allowed. And then just boom, I remember this Frank Wells quote, every door we opened had money behind it. And you said your lives changed so much, and not necessarily for the better, in your opinion. I thought that was really fascinating.
Yeah. Well, I mean, most outsiders would look at it and say, for the better, clearly. And, you know, you can't argue with money. Money would make most lives better. But we were suddenly kind of rolling in it in a way we never had been before. And it was more public than it had been before. You know, I mean, my name was up until then associated with all good things and happiness and, you know, the best day you had in your childhood and those kinds of things.
Except for Bambi. Yeah, I have to say that the worst I have very vivid memories of Bambi as a kid, but go on.
Yeah, some more wholesome than others. But every time I would use my credit card, I would know what the name meant to people. And there was a stark shift. And what it started meaning to people was rich. And insanely rich and obscenely rich. And I, you know, the switch was pretty sudden. And it was clear that the whole world was watching that happen at Disney and marveling at it. But it was definitely adding a nuance to the brand that, you know, I hadn't had to contend with before. And it was hard in that it was embarrassing. It generated a lot of complexities for me personally and for our family altogether. And they weren't always good. Of course, most of them are good. But, you know, people all want something from you. You can't have a conversation with anyone where they're not thinking, oh, well, this is my chance to ask for this. And so, you know, the dynamics of a lot of your relationships really change.
I would think so,
and yeah. I think, a lot of people with a lot of money have a tendency to kind of settle into a known group of characters and then never move outside of that group because it's just too exhausting, right? You don't know what you're going to get. And then you start living these kind of sheltered lives. And then you add to it the things that wealthy people do for themselves, like private planes and private rooms and private entrances and the rest of it. And you can really create an environment in which you just simply never interact with anyone normal again. And it is, in my opinion, incredibly erosive to your character.
You know, I remember this chat I had with Bob Zemeckis, who, of course, who framed Roger Rabbit for Disney.
Yeah,
he was just talking about this incredible unhappiness of being really, really rich. And it was very illuminating to me. He sort of said, in a way, you're not satisfied with anything because you think you're constantly entitled to it, for everything to be kind of perfect. And there's this constant, like, how can it rain when I'm on vacation thing going on. So.
I haven't had quite that reaction, but I have. It does feel like everything could be better all the time, and then there's always somebody with more, right? And you end up focusing on it in a way you never would have had things been different. You end up turning into a person you wouldn't have been, and I think that happens to a lot of people, whether you like it or not, because it's also like having this really, I keep saying, like this really fancy dog with a really fancy coat, and now you have to just comb this dog all the time. I mean, when you have a lot of money, you have to think about it all the time, like, where's it going to be? Who's going to have it? You know, what are you going to do about the tax on this? And, you know, talk about complexity. It, you know, nobody, yes. You know, with a high net worth reads their own tax return. It would be impossible.
Yes, I've seen it. I've had a front row seat. I feel like as a journalist covering Hollywood, mm-hmm. I've seen the great unhappiness that money can bring, especially for the offspring of, you know, people who have seen their children, you know, literally die from drugs and drift. Yeah. And it's a really tough thing, I think, to grow up in a family like that.
There's a funny thing, because the numbers of deaths of suicide and drug overdose, which we can call deaths by unhappiness, tend to roughly be the same as those among incredibly poor people. And that sounds really, like a terrible comparison to make, except that what you learn, especially if you grow up in that kind of climate, is that poverty is actually a perpetual companion, because you never really feel like you have enough. You never really feel like you've done enough. You never feel really good enough. That sort of not enough thing is chasing you all the time, unless you can really break free of the dynamics and change the way you think about the world. And that is why you see high amounts of divorce. That doesn't surprise me at all. It just changes the dynamics of every room you walk into and every relationship you have.
Well, you know, with a name like Disney, I don't know, did you ever think maybe I should just change it so I don't have to carry this?
Yeah, absolutely. And I know a couple actually of Rockefellers who changed their names. But, I came right up to the edge of it when I got married. That was the most obvious
that was an easy one. Yeah.
And I ran up against, first of all, that I was too much of a feminist to do it. But really,
well,
truly.
Part's hard. It was easy except for that.
when I came up to the edge of it and really looked at it, I thought, you know what? It's asking something from me. And I don't love all that stuff that comes with it, but I don't hate all of it either. And it is something I'm proud of, even if there are aspects of it which I really didn't, want to have to apologize for all the time. You know, the McCarthy hearings and the labor thing. And there's a lot of it I'm not proud of, but there was enough of it to be proud of to listen when I heard it saying to me that I have work to do related to it. And that's what's, I'm sorry, I'm not really a religious person, but it felt like, there was a calling and I was going to have to try and figure out how to do that, whatever was called of me.
Yes, and now you're doing it. Let me just do a little bit more talking about the history of Disney, because, I have incredibly vivid memories of when your father led an insurrection against the Michael Eisner, things had gone south. He rallied the shareholders. And I honestly was at this board meeting, this critical board meeting in Philadelphia at that period where
I was there too.
Were you there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And yeah. I remember I was outside. They were holding a meeting, as you remember, next to the official Disney meeting in the next door. And
yeah, I thought
there'll be a few people here. It'll be like chairs and rows. And then I looked out of this window. I was across the street and there was a line around the block as if this were a Star Wars opening, the first one. And just people like the old and the infirm and strollers baby and the power of that Disney magic and your father's ability to rally these shareholders. It stunned me, but I guess maybe it didn't, I don't know, did it stun you? I was stunned.
It didn't surprise me, actually, because I was working on the website we had and I had been doing a lot of the kind of speaking on behalf of my father to, I don't know, the pension funds and people like that. So I had been traveling around kind of supporting him in that. And I could feel the feeling in the air, and I had, experienced things like getting a note from a Disney employee when I was in the park saying, "You've got to help us." It was not for nothing that were people calling it Auschwitz at the time. It really had, it's horrible, right? I mean, it's just a horrible. So my father was totally right. My father was absolutely right. And I wanted to support him in any way that I could. And, you know, it's nice when you're absolutely right and you have the weight of that name, plus you look like him.
I was going to say, he had the name and that face. He looked so much like Walt.
Yeah. And he also had a lot of the sort of body characteristics, you know, he was sort of slouchy and, you know, kind of loose like Walt was and things like that. Anyway, there were a million things. And he was right. And there was something... So this is why I'm doing what I'm doing now, because, you know, there's something so much more important than just a ball bearing company about this company, right? It carries people's dreams. And I'm sorry that I have to go all sort of woo-woo sounding, but it's true that people invest a lot of their own hearts and their families into this company. And so when it feels like it's going off the rails, the hurt that's felt, you know, not just for employees, but the people who really love the company is huge. And then there's the fact that, you know, it's a really widely held stock. It's such an interesting stock.
Yes.
Because the folks at AOL Time Warner had just had a no vote for Steve Case, which was like something like 14%, and he had resigned the next day because he was so horrified at the
right.
terrible no vote.
That was such
and they
a,
only
another
had to
disaster.
Organize like,
yeah,
they only had to organize like 6 or 7 individual shareholders to get there.
Mm-hmm.
We had tens of thousands of, we basically had the American public we had to rally because people own 5 shares, 10 shares, and they get in their like RVs and drive to wherever the shareholders meeting is and show up. It's a really extraordinary stock that way. I don't know if there's another one like it. And so the shareholders meeting is really an interesting event. And I don't know if you remember that Philadelphia meeting, that it was really cold inside.
Inside where Michael and Eisner was speaking?
Yeah, I think they turned the heat off. I mean, like, my nose was starting to freeze, and I could see my breath. I think they were trying to do everything in their power to make sure everybody left because it was boring, because they were tired, because they were cold. So they deliberately dragged this meeting on and made it really cold. And then when they announced the numbers, because they didn't want a big uproar from the audience, because they knew that's what the news cameras were there for. So they didn't want a moment. And so they announced, when they finally announced vote, Michael, if you remember, tried to shut the meeting down. He said, I think we've covered all our business before he read the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Which was like, you know, come on, Michael. It's the most disingenuous thing in the world. And then he read the numbers raw. I don't know if you remember that. He just read in absolute numbers. And
I remember being sort of like, wait, what was that?
Yeah. And so there was like a little murmur in the crowd, and everybody's doing the mental math in their heads. And like little by little, the people are saying, oh. And I was like, what is that? Like 35%? No, it's 38%. Oh my God. Oh my God. And then the roar goes up, but it wasn't, you know, they did a great job. I guess from a PR standpoint, they did a great job of managing what the news people would come home with. But then their response
was
pretty insufficient.
Yeah. Let's talk about your podcast. You had decided to do a podcast, which is called All Ears.
Yeah.
And you get to have amazing guests, Elizabeth Warren, Stacey Abrams, Mary Trump, Sam B, who's been on this show.
Yeah. And some other people you haven't heard of who are really thinking. I mean, I get to have this great life where I somehow by luck and happenstance know a lot of great people and can pick up the phone and call people and they'll take my call. And so because of that, I get to sit down with like the most interesting people in the world. So I try to focus on people who are troublemakers like me. And talk about why they make trouble and you know what they think needs to happen and it just winds up being like this. It winds up being a chat and a conversation, and I'm continually learning the ways in which I was wrong and the things I didn't know. And you know, nothing is more pleasurable than a really smart conversation with a really smart person.
I think so too, and I've had one just now.
Bless you.
Abigail Disney is a filmmaker, activist, philanthropist, and host of the podcast All Ears. Thank you. That was great. Really appreciate
it. Thank you so much. What a pleasure.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with help this week from Kat Yore. Paul Smith mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
I spent all day in my head.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.